Yeah, what, the digital ID you turn?
Yeah, digital ID you turn.
You called it.
What, sorry?
You called it.
I told you this stuff was not going to happen.
I think we very diplomatically got the line right on that day.
The best...
Because I said that, like, I understand why they want to do this, but I don't think it's politically possible. Yeah, it's not, capital.
It's not within the instinct of the Labour Party. It's not the instinct of the government. The best defence of it I heard was Ed Miliband on LBC.
What did he say?
Governments make mistakes all the time. That was literally the only defence of the government policy, I thought. Fair enough.
What's left? Back again in the stew, season Blood Clot. Two. Are you mad? We're back sooner than expected as well, yeah, because we were planning on taking a little break, but it's been going, Everything's been going crazy since we decided to take some time off from What's Left HQ. So we're back again.
What's Left HQ?
Well, I mean, the roaming like HQ. The thing is, yeah, we've been in so many different studios now, and I don't even know where home is.
Yeah.
I'm moving like a
migrant.
Although
I do like this one. As I said, this one does me sweet, so I can't really complain.
Hey, man, we could make this look. We're looking at myself on the screen right now. We're looking great. So yeah, I mean, look.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's been a crazy start to 2026. But first and foremost, Jay, how are you?
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I'm good. I'm not going to lie, I'm actually already exhausted. There's too much stuff to think about. But I had a nice Christmas, had a nice time. So yeah, what about yourself?
Good. Yeah, I'm good. I feel like it's going to be quite a big year for us.
Very much a big year.
You know, we put a lot of effort into last year to try and build something new. And it feels really amazing to have a little bit of momentum and that people are listening.
Yeah,
and enjoying.
People are listening, engaging. Yeah. Chatting shit. So that's all right.
Have you been recognised yet?
Yeah, there have been a few kind of what's left is in the world. Yeah, so shout out to those people.
I got stopped on New Year's Eve, bro.
Really?
In France.
Yeah, actually, I was at a party over New Year's and someone stopped me and said hello. And I don't know, I was like, you shouldn't be seeing me here.
Oh, really? Why? Why are you out of madness? What are you? Naughty boy, no photos, yeah? Yeah, some kid, I was walking past him in this club on New Year's Eve and he was like, yo, because I just wanted to say, like, I watched the episode of Jordan and George. And I was like,
mad.
In France, bro, of all places. And he was like, yeah, he was on the same flight as me. He was like,
really good.
I saw you on the flight, but I didn't want to disturb you. And I was like, dude, you feel free to disturb you whenever.
All you want. Yeah,
whenever.
That's mad.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, it's good to feel like we're cutting through right now. One of the changes this year, guys, is What's Left is now on Substack. So if you want to get exclusive content, if you want to see the whole interview, unedited, extra content, want to chat to us, talk to our guests for future episodes, please move over there and get involved. And thank you so much for your support for everyone who does.
Very much so, yeah.
So, Jay, what to talk about first in 2026? There's about 500 different things we could choose, but I think number one on the list is we've got to talk about what Trump's been doing in the White House.
This is after Venezuela on New Year's Day. Before that, blowing up Nigeria. My boy's doing some madness in Iran. So yeah, I think there is a lot to cover.
Well, look, on the Iran stuff, I think probably feels like most relevant right now since that's what's like kind of like active.
But it is crazy how much shit has gone on in the time since we broke up.
Yeah, it's always this time of year, isn't it? New year, people are like, you know, wake up. It's like their political powers are like, it's time for you lot to take notice about what's happening next.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, like the Christmas Day strikes in Nigeria and then the New Year's Day...
The Nigerian ones flew under the radar.
Under the radar,
no one knew about that.
This is what I find amazing. Like, there was like a shock and awe policy that took place over the Christmas period, and we were all very much awake to it whilst being very much kind of chilled out and asleep and doing our own thing. That, like, these lots started 2026.
And they had Nicki Minaj as well
going on.
What the hell was Nicki Minaj doing, bro?
Have the utmost respect and admiration for our president.
Although the kind of fanatical Christian thing is such a Caribbean thing to do. So when I see that she's Trini or from Jamaica or whatever it is, I'm like, I see that for you.
Well, we've got to talk to our guest about this today, bro. This is relevant. This is relevant stuff. So, yeah, I mean, look, I want to talk a little bit about the rising of this multipolarity, this multipolar world order, which is how it's being currently described. We've been speaking about this different emergence of world powers, a return to spheres of influence for quite a while on this show. So I hope it wasn't a surprise to any of our viewers or listeners when this stuff has started to unfold. But I think it's really clear, isn't it? Trump is underwater in polls.
He's not popular right now on his domestic agenda. There is a need, and there's always been an attraction for American presidents to flex the muscles and the power of the American military-industrial complex when they are in positions of need. And I think that's what's going on right now. I think that this ability to show that we can just do this and no one can stop us is about him trying to project power on a world stage to deflect from the difficulties that are happening at home.
But I think it's a bit more than that, in that the president, he's trying to refashion the world in a Trumpian worldview. So as much as it's an exercise of power and an assertion of dominance, the whole thing seems like a narcissistic reflection to ensure that this Donald Trump hegemony just stands and is established in every part of the hemisphere. And I think we've gone from something of a multipolarity world, which you've kind of suggested, to a hemispheric world. To me, it's very much the West now pitted against the East, or the West, Europe and the East, which I think we're seeing with the kind of Iran dynamics, the increasing conversation around China, and then naturally the kind of Russia conversation and Greenland and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, it's different to the Cold War, like the Iron Curtain. I don't think people are going to be talking about an Iron Curtain this time around, right? Like the borders are different, the borders are new. The satellite states that the Soviets used to have within the Western Hemisphere, which were, you know, the reason why they were there, were to arrest American power projection and to say, actually, we are players in this stage as well. That is being undone before our eyes. And I think, obviously, Venezuela, they had a strong relationship with Russia. Maduro expected Putin to be there to support him. They expected the Russian intelligence services to be able to give them, a warning of the fact that this attack was going to come, that he was going to get taken out. It never came. Iran, the same. It never came, right? Something has changed here, fundamentally, right? And one thing you could say is that perhaps Putin and Russia, they're overextended at the moment in Ukraine, where their focus of the intelligence services and the military is being focused on that front. So they don't have the bandwidth to look at what is happening in Iran, what happened in Syria. Again, Bashar al-Assad expected, I believe, to have some support from Russians. All they were saying was, come get on a flight to Moscow, son. And apparently now he hasn't got enough money to stay in any hotels. I don't know if
really?
You know that. Yeah, apparently that's the story of with Assad. So something is happening here that is seismic and new, which is that the Monroe Doctrine, which we've spoken about on the podcast before, but it's this idea that in the Western Hemisphere, there is no threat to the United States. It goes back to the 1800s, this policy. Ever since America's been powerful enough to enforce it, they have moved to ensure that there are no threats, no adversaries to the US in that part of the world. And Venezuela obviously stood out as a rogue state who don't want to be
with
in the pocket
significant
of the US.
Oil reserves, no less.
No less. And as you talked about just then, shaping it in the image of the deal maker, of course there is a transactional bent to what's going on here.
I mean, and he's so brazen and blatant about the whole thing. He literally is stating, I am doing this for oil and American companies are going to take charge of it. You couldn't be more obvious about your intentions than I think we've seen at any point throughout history, probably, where there's been an argument for democracy, or as much as kind of despotic regime change is also an aspect of it, there is very much a view that we are doing this for oil and it's just going to enrich the American public.
There's no moral posturing.
No, not at all.
There's no attempt to say this is actually about our liberal values, or that we're working within the confines of international law and actually this is legitimate, which was the framework that was used in Iraq.
It's also how successful they've been able to manipulate an image of Maduro within the space of, 21 days from being somebody who's an inconvenience and has a human rights abuse record to someone who is this violent, vicious character, fundamentally against American interests, poses a legitimate threat to the United States. All of this has been curated as he's been washed ashore to the United States, which I find quite interesting.
Yeah, because they were framing it about drugs.
Exactly.
I think that narrative has really fallen by the wayside now. In any case, America hasn't got a massive cocaine problem. It's got a fentanyl problem. And that's coming from Mexico, not through Venezuela, right? But on Maduro, that Nike tech fleece, fair play, bro. been flying off the shelves, my boy. You know what I'm saying? Like, Halloween is locked down this year,
I'm not
going
to lie. He kind of looked hard.
He looked hard. He looked hard. I mean, someone tweeted that it's technically torture to deprive somebody's senses in that image. But he didn't look like he was getting tortured, bro. He was just, he looked like he was just chilling in the tech fleece. But yeah, look, man, I think this is an important juncture in what a lot of foreign policy analysts knew was coming, which was that America wants Europe and the rest of the world to know that this is a world of hard power. And unless you have those means, you don't have a seat at the table.
But did Europe really know this was coming? Because we saw some of the mapping of this, we saw some of this projected to us late last year when the government released, what was the document that the Trump government released?
The National Security Strategy.
Yeah. And even then, I think Europe was still to a point complacent about how they will enact any of this stuff. Will they even enact any of this stuff? And there hasn't been a cohesive response. And now all of a sudden, NATO is potentially under threat. Yeah. Europe's
but
just
they're putting troops on Greenland,
yeah,
bro.
Isn't that
they're
crazy?
Dropping troops. Sweden and Denmark are dropping troops on Greenland in case there's an invasion by a NATO ally. Yeah, but I think when you look, if you speak privately to European analysts, and I've got friends who work in the EU, they've been worried about this since the chance of Trump coming back post January 6th and the Capitol insurrection. They've been concerned about this. Why does it feel like there is a separation between the rhetoric of the Europeans and Trump? They don't feel like they've got a robust strategic response to what Trump is saying. It's because Europe has vassalized. Mm-hmm. And we've been speaking about this from a UK context, but it's exactly the same anywhere you go in Europe.
It's subservient to its American overlord.
We are subservient to Trump, Daddy Trump, as Mark Rutte, the General Secretary of NATO, put it. You know, these guys hold the cards. Why? Because we have nowhere near the same defensive capabilities as the US. In fact, our defensive capabilities are contingent on the US.
On the United States, yeah.
So the UK's nuclear submarine, I think the salience of this stuff is now going up. People are actually learning this. The Trident program, our nukes are serviced by America. So if you're an Atlanticist, someone who believes in the longevity of the UK's relationship with the US, you know, you are fully aware, at least in terms of if you're working in Whitehall, about how much
your security is contingent on the United States.
Exactly.
And I think one of the great regrets of the UK in the 21st century will be the extent to which it hollowed out its own infrastructure in support of the Americans, and in so doing has conceded any political ground, any autonomous political ground that we may exercise around the world, in light of the fact that we have the Commonwealth, which I'm sure we'll speak about going further. But in light of the fact that we have good relationships with people around the world, we have conceded all of that to the militaristic might of the US. And I think that's quite unforgivable.
That's an indictment.
Really.
Yeah, I mean, I think the belief was within Westminster, regardless of which party was involved, was that there would not be a reality in which the strategic interests of the UK passed fully apart from the strategic interests of the US. It's happened. And we were warned about this ever since 2016, really. I mean, Trump has been speaking quite consistent terms since the first. I mean, he was talking about Venezuela in the first administration anyway, right? So we've had time to think about this, but how do you actually fix it when you don't have any strategic autonomy, when you don't have the money, for instance, to invest into your own
into your own
domestic military capabilities? One of the big, you know, moves of the EU and the UK recently was to up the percentage of GDP spending on defence. But the problem is with that move is that most of that money in procurement, military procurement, is being wasted anyway.
How so? What, on domestic?
So we have a domestic budget for, and a lot of it, what we get for how much we put in is ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, ridiculous.
And a lot of those companies are American. So what we've done now is we've said we have to spend this much money, more money. We don't have the right places to spend it. And the market's only in the States.
Only in the United, yeah.
So we've basically said we're just going to give these lot more money to invest in systems
own,
that, again, dependent
their
on
own
them.
Shit. Yeah, I know.
It is madness. It is pure, pure madness. But these are the policy decisions that have been made over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Hence why Europe says nothing, looks spineless. You know, and Trump knows that. And his thing was, you know, I'm going to call your bluff and I'm going to expose you lot about how dependent you really are.
But those bluffs were called when he started imposing tariffs on the European Union and on the UK and when we thought we were slightly better off, given we hadn't had the same extent of tariffs to other places around the world. He was calling our bluff many months before he was starting to militarily advance his interest in parts of NATO. So I think there's a foolhardiness on the part of the UK to misunderstand his intentions and really where his allyship is. And it is entirely to his project.
That security document, the US strategic defense document, is really important because in that document it says the US plan to cultivate resistance in Europe for types of politics that are against their interests.
Well, they want nationalist politics, really. Isn't that to fragment the cohesive organization of the European Union? Could it not be seen as such?
I think it definitely is. I mean, it is existential what they're saying. It's the current European trajectory, in that, according to that document, is not one of these guys have different interests to us. This is a national security problem.
Well, it's of competing interests.
Because of demographic replacement, i.e. because of migration. So what they're saying is native white European populations, the more that the complexion of that society changes because of inward migration, the more those societies become a threat to the US. And if we're seeing what the US is now doing to its threats, what does that mean for the rest of Europe?
The shining light on the hill or whatnot that they like to consider themselves. I think people like J.D. Vance see America as the new Europe. They see Britain and the European continent racked with a migration crisis, as you've said. And so they now are the civilized enlighteners of the Western Hemisphere, and they're leaving people like us by the wayside because we no longer fit that American ideal, I don't think.
Yeah, but the American ideal has shifted.
Which is deeply racialized, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's become racialized in a way that, of course, America's got a deep history with racism. But if you really think about the founding fathers and what they were suggesting within their republican values, it was that if you believed in the values and you came from Europe, white Europe.
Well, that was the massive caveat.
And you came from white Europe, you could be an American. Whereas now what they're saying is, regardless of your belief in values, there's been some blood and soil fusing between these white European migrants who've become American over the last 300 years. And now that there is an American, you know, nationalist, grounded in history identity, that's racialized.
An ethnic identity.
They ain't even from there originally, Ruboy.
Which I found striking, given that I think Mr. Trump said, just because you landed in a boat in Greenland 500 years ago doesn't mean that you were in the land. This guy.
It's incredible, isn't it? But I don't think it's lost on him, that the irony of that. I think he enjoys
it. Oh, yeah, he very much enjoys it.
He enjoys
it,
the satire. He knows it's going to rub people up the wrong way. But, you know, if you look to Iran now and what's going on there, there have been estimations that up to 12,000 Iranian citizens have been killed in repression of the current anti-regime protests. That is a massive number of people, if true. I think it's important to kind of think here about what happens next, because we've seen regime changes many times throughout history. And often what is sold with a promise of hope descends into chaos, creates a power vacuum, and then all hell breaks loose. And the big question now is, firstly, in Venezuela, the regime change has happened. So let's see what happens next with Delcy Rodriguez, who is the second in command, who's now become the president of Venezuela. Will she bend the knee to the US's oil interests? Will she make sure that everything runs smoothly? Will it descend into chaos? And in Iran, my understanding is that there won't be any regime change without foreign intervention. And so the US has to make a calculation about whether they're going to directly intervene or not. Yeah. Now, direct intervention is, I'm going to distinguish between two different things that the US government could do right now. So as we record this episode, and by the time this goes out, it probably will have changed, but there is a blackout on communications in Iran. People can't communicate, there's no internet. So one form of intervention they could do, which I imagine they will do, is that Elon Musk will put up a Starlink satellite and they will turn the internet on, which is a form of interference, right? Because what they're essentially doing is enabling the organization of revolutionary anti-regime forces. Mm-hmm. Another option for them to do would be some form of airstrikes, military capability, you know, via Israel, most likely. They haven't opted for that course of action. The reason I think they haven't opted for that is because They know that as soon as the bombs start falling and civilians start getting indiscriminately bombed, the mood can change amongst those revolutionary forces.
Into an anti-American sentiment.
Into an anti-imperialist, anti-American sentiment. They're already walking this a very interesting tightrope where someone like the Shah of Iran, so his descendant Reza Shah, Reza Pahlavi II was the head of Iran when he was deposed in 1979 by the first revolution. His son now is the kind of bulwark figure about a return to a monarchist regime. His name is being heard on the streets and people are shouting him out. My understanding of this was that amongst the power brokers in Iran, many of the educated classes in particular, this guy's a joke.
The king.
He's been considered a joke, you know, forever, since the revolution, right? You know, they remember why the revolution happened. A quick explainer on the revolution. The Shah was wonderfully corrupt. It's kind of typical. He was in the pocket of the West.
Having massive parties in the desert, I think.
Yeah, which is also not restrained to just Iran. That happens a lot in the Middle East amongst the ruling classes. But they were corrupt. There was increasing wealth inequality in the country. There was anger. There were very disparate forces who wanted to revolt. There was also brutal state repression. So all of the same things that have coalesced again this time round.
And are typically the recipes for revolutionary activity anyway. Of course, anyway.
History repeats.
Indeed.
So why am I talking about the Shah? The reason I'm talking about it is because it's really interesting that this person who was basically considered a joke is now being considered as someone who could be a legitimate cohering force. By some on the outside, I think internally in Iran, it would still be difficult given the disparate nature of the people who are wanting to revolt against the autocratic Islamist Shiite regime. I think the likelihood is this is going to end in a very brutal state repression of the kind that Saddam Hussein did.
That bloody, you suspect.
So that repression, they think, upwards of 150,000 Iraqis were killed by the regime, which is
horrifying.
I mean, it is an astounding number. They don't know for certain how many people died. But George Bush Sr., they had the opportunity after Operation Desert Shield, I think, or Desert Storm, whichever it's called, to go into Iraq and to depose Saddam. And there were advisors, hawks at the time, saying, "Go, now's the time to strike." But he didn't want to do it. And so what they did was they encouraged the Iraqis there and said, rise up,
yeah,
you know,
rise
fight.
Up against your government. And
yeah, and fight and kill, you know, fight and
overthrow
and push back.
Your government.
And what happened? When they needed the help, it didn't turn up. And a lot of people died. And it wasn't forgotten, you know. I don't doubt that the Iranian regime right now is on its way irreversibly to being overthrown. But if you look at just the way the power brokers are right now, the people you would need to have a proper revolution, you need people in the Revolutionary Guard to decide that now's the time, people with military support and military power to change their minds and back the back regime change.
Intellectuals, political leaders,
yeah,
those of movement and communities. It's not just a kind of vanguard of a small cabal who's willing to take state power.
Yeah, and also the intellectuals tend to not have weapons. So they that
weapons of the mind.
Yeah, but that hence doesn't help when you're in a gunfight, big man. So we'll see what happens there. I'm not holding my breath for regime change yet in Iran, but I do think that destabilization is going to have some big knock-on effects.
And I guess, do you then expect the United States to take a more prominent role in any of that? Or do you think the United States could instigate regime change and, much like you said with the Iraqis, leave those people to kind of fend it out for themselves?
I think the likelihood is they're going to let them see how the cards land. I think in their book, if plenty of them die, Iranian civilians, they would feel vindicated in portraying the Iranian regime as evil, and which they are, totalitarian.
Well, it would justify,
whatever, which they, of course, they are, but
which, yeah, naturally justifies any form of foreign intervention.
Further down the line.
Yeah.
But the problem is that that's a very, firstly, you know, and this is something that Aaron Bastani might argue about, for instance, because the thing that I've heard Bastani, who is half Iranian, talk about a lot is that this is the consequence of crippling sanctions. So in his book, you know, it's not just that the Iranian regime is, you know, morally bankrupt, corrupt, whatever, brutally repressive. It can be all of those things. But because of the nature of how crippling the sanctions regime has been on Iran, we have precipitated the conditions by which things can get worse, well, worse. And more people can die.
Aren't inflation rates upwards of 40% or something?
It is been ludicrous. Yeah. I mean, the economic crisis in Iran.
Unemployment, all of it, yeah.
But also, it's not lost on the Iranian citizens, right, that Iran sends money, pays for the wages of Hezbollah. So you can be a proxy fighter in Lebanon, and you're getting paid however many times the average salary of an Iranian citizen. You know, these guys know, you know, a lot of these people do not want to be fighting a big proxy war, but it is existential for the regime who say in their declaration that they are against the state of Israel, right?
Yeah.
So there's no clean, I don't think, analysis about what's happening here. But I think what's happened, and this is what 2026 was going to be a very different year to the past two or three, is that the anti-imperialist cohort of the Commentariat will be faced with the people who are, you know, the Venezuelans or the Iranians or whatever, doing some really fucked up shit. They're going to see brutal state repression like this. And it's going to change the kind of moral picture, I think, of the conversation.
It is interesting to see, I guess, where does an internationalist left go from here with all the politics of anti-imperialism and, in the case of Maduro, a kind of explicitly socialist project? How accommodating people may be of deeply unsavory practices because it approximates themselves to a particular idea of the world or whatever. And I'm curious to see how does this develop the left more broadly, not just within the kind of mainstream left, but even when we're thinking about advances of potential your party and the people that may be interested in left.
You're still talking about your party?
Well, no, I mean, I just think it...
You think they're relevant still?
No, I don't think they're relevant at all. I think they're increasingly irrelevant. But what I would say
is... They're still loud on Twitter.
There are people... Yeah, there's obviously loud on Twitter, but there will be people who, in this country, will still be attracted to them because they see the international affairs and feel as though that is a coherent left-wing project that could be implemented here, is what I'm trying to say, if that makes sense. Yeah. Because there's a very skewed reading of anti-imperialism that I think parts of the left embrace that can very quickly, if not addressed, become part of a body politics that is legitimized in elections or something of that sort.
Which is to say, in practice, what sort of policies do you think that they, what sort of policy platform would they argue
well,
for?
I mean, apologia of particular regimes because they are...
Anti-Western.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they have a very heavy reading, a heavy Western critique of society today. And some of those things may be legitimate, and I think much of it is deeply illegitimate. But there's a cohort of voters and interested people who are willing to try and enact some of those things, whether it's in a local authority or in national parliaments.
Well, I think that's part of the reason why there is more quiet on the activist fringe of the left when talking about Iran, is because of the discomfort of, you know, there are some people who are just so anti-Zionist in their politics that they will not critique anyone who is seen to be a facilitator of resistance against the Zionist entity, as they put it, right? Which is to say that because Iran funds Hamas and the Houthis and Hezbollah, they are legitimate.
Was
and
it my friend's
justified.
Enemy is my friend or something?
Yeah, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yeah,
classic. And I think that does explain a little bit of the quiet around some of those very vocal activisty, clicktivisty on the Instagram stories talk of people about what's going on in Iran, because that is their own, you know, they are so ideological about that.
That is their own politics.
Yeah. Which is, I think, a politics of racism. If you really dig deep into it.
But it's also a deeply simplistic view of the world, which renders anything to a left-right binary or an East versus West or a kind of post-colonial versus a colonial world order or however they see it.
I think there is a coalition, or at least an allegiance, between some radical, very radical communist-type leftists and Islamists, you know, where they say something along the lines of, this system that we live under is corrupt and it's broken, and so we will do anything to overthrow it.
And I think, well, I'd say it's less of a communist thing, but a very particular anti-imperialist reading that originates in what I see to be a deep hatred of Western society And it's really nothing more than that, is how I see it, is because they don't have the ability to recognize all of the nuance that history has developed to this point in time, and are willing to concede any intellectual ground just because they don't believe in it, and they have an instinct that the West is inherently bad, which I just don't believe in.
Yeah, yeah. I think that is exactly it. They really believe that our society is the most evil thing that needs to be dismantled immediately. And so they can make a coalition together. But I think what's interesting is, as I said earlier, in the power vacuum that emerged post the 79 revolution, in the run-up to it, Khomeini, who the Ayatollah before Khamenei, was firstly not in Iran. He was outside of Iran and he was broadcasting stuff against the regime, right? And Khomeini was saying basically that he was a man to represent all people, and that all of the different factions who were opposed to the Shah, he was their unifying candidate.
Oh, really interesting.
And then what happened as soon as the revolution happened? Round them up, yep. Murdered them.
Yeah.
Textbook, Stalinism, textbook, right? Like, when the power vacuum emerges, take your most powerful competitors and kill them off.
Knock your opponents out.
Yeah, kill them off. So I'm just saying that, like, be careful what you wish for, you know, and that people can be, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing, you know.
I do think that would be the lesson of 2026, is just being careful what you wish for, because yeah. There are going to be a lot of wolves. No,
I'd say for Trump, right, because Trump has destabilized the world. He's instituted regime change in one country, and it looks like regime change in another.
Whilst affirming and stabilizing his own position on the world.
And also destabilizing his own country. If you look at what's going on right now with, you know, the ICE murdered that woman who was driving away in the car. Like, America is a tinderbox, and it's getting worse, right? Like, he is consistently choosing the more authoritarian option of being able to manage and leverage his power over all others. So be careful what you wish for. You know, you've got power. You're exercising it. But if you make the world just so clearly transactional about if you can, you know, control this, you know, this outcome, then you can do what you want. Be careful what you wish for, because see how people will behave in a world where God is dead and there are no morals.
Yeah. I've been reading a bit of St. Augustine recently.
Really? How come? From what perspective?
I find his views of sin deeply interesting.
Augustine of Hippo.
And yeah, top man.
North African geezer. Yeah, come on.
I think maybe because of how crazy the world is becoming, the concept of an omnipresent God I find challenging. But I do believe that there is a moral choice to make between actively partaking in sin against trying to do some form of good. And I think with that moral framework, it's allowing me actually to understand the world a bit better in line with my own views. And Trump and all of these things that are going on, to me, is the expression of, like, it's the manifestation of a St. Augustine worldview of what is sin and evil against what is good and potentially an enlightened godly path to take.
Interesting, because Augustine, like Malcolm X, lived a life of hedonism.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, that's what I found interesting was that my man was clarting out, clarting gal for what, like
was
the first
300 or whatever it was.
Yeah, what, 390 BC or whatever. AD, that's it.
Yeah. He was getting about like Malcolm X, clarting bare
gal.
And then they turned to religion. Trump, on all accounts, was not only doing that, but also
And turning to badness.
And has doubled down on the badness. So I think the fact is we live in a decadent world full of hedonism, and there's a choice to be made now for all of us who've been down this path, are we going to choose the more enlightened, more option, or are we going to double down?
Yeah. And in a world where God is dead, the choice is...
Well, all is permitted.
Definitely ours. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to snap straight in. I'm going to snap straight in because... Lynn, what time do you call this?
Oh, soz.
1 hour?
I know, 45.
I'm going to say there's some stereotypes that I can lean into right now.
And I'm happy to wear that with pride.
So you come all the way from Essex, working from home, yeah, life, mm-hmm, into the studio today. I was thinking about what's the best way to kind of introduce you to the audience, but you're a broadcaster, contrarian.
People have said that.
Landlord.
Yeah.
And very much headstrong about your opinion, which we love.
Yeah.
And we
love. Which is the one that gives you the most grief?
What area of work?
Yeah.
All for different reasons, I guess. Because when I work in public sector, I used to work on the front line. And I deal with so many different sorts of people. So, like, I've had a sword held up to me, locked in a house. I've had someone jump over and try to attack me in a court hearing. So that's pretty stressful. But then all the way to getting dragged online.
Sword held up to you, you're going to have to unpack that one for me.
Yeah, so I started working in housing about 14 years ago. And just like a very entry level. And being on the front line as a like housing officer, you have to deal with like, well, not all, but I dealt with mixed tenure. So that essentially means that could be like shared ownership, help to buy, dealing with right to buy, but also social tenancies, which comes with a lot of like people that suffer from mental health. Or like I was a fraud officer, and that meant having to go to people's homes that hadn't been in contact with the general public for whatever reason for many years. So you're the first person or contact that they're having, and they've ostracized themselves from society for a reason. So I'm there like, news. Hi.
So you were a bailiff.
Yeah. Yeah, why are you
I wasn't even a bailiff, no. I was, do you know what? I found it really interesting. I would go in and I'd sit down for an hour and have a chat. And then like, you know, you really learn and understand people from like your working class white nan who's 90, who's got no kids and is extremely lonely, to your like roadman who his flat's been overtaken for cuckooing for county lines. Like you just see it all in housing.
Man.
So
is that across London or is that mainly in Essex?
No, London.
Yeah. That was in London.
So yeah.
Do you think that radicalised you to your current political position? Because I found out a piece of information about you that I didn't.
Oh yeah.
Did you used to work for the Labour Party?
Yeah.
That's mad.
Mad.
That makes three of us.
That's three of us.
Yeah, in Tottenham, I used to be a BAME officer.
BAME officer in the for local the party. Labour Party. You got paid for that?
Yeah.
Mad. What does a BAME officer do? Because I feel like you hate identity politics.
Yeah,
so
and you
that.
Hate Labour, right?
Do you know what? It's not that I hate identity politics. I hate when it's placed in front of anything else. Do you know what I mean?
Explain that.
So, okay, for example, I don't mind if someone says the first woman to go to the moon or the first black scientist or whatever the case may be. But what I don't like is when it's like used as a banner for your entire identity. Like take if I take away who like you being a man, you being straight or gay, you being handsome. Asian, black or white or whatever. Mm. I'm sure many think that. If I take those things away, I should still be able to have a lot of substance for me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's used as an excuse sometimes. Because I'm X, I should be able to do Y.
I think, but it's not, do you know what? It's not even just like ethnic communities or whatever. We've seen it everywhere now. Like I'm a working class white guy and I'm a victim, or I'm a black person still suffering from slavery, like, or all these different things. And I think, yeah, everyone has gone through things. And I don't think we should do, you know.
So what do you say to the black guy who's still suffering from slavery?
How do you know you are? If you were to be born and no one ever told you that 500 years ago, some of your ancestors were potentially slaves, how would you know that you're suffering from it?
But is it not in your culture and almost the generational trauma that some may argue that's been passed down over generations? You wouldn't have to be told to know that.
I think
you
would have to be.
Really? Do you think so?
Yeah, I think. Well, obviously, if you're being told by your whole community, you're going to be subjected to it and exposed to it. But let's say, for example, I was homeschooled and I didn't really hear about any of these things. And my father was born in Barbados. I was born in Barbados. My mother was born in Pakistan. So I'm still like first gen. So when I moved to like Tottenham and I started growing up and hearing all this like identity politics or civil rights movement or issues with the police, F the police or the history of slavery, it was new to me. So, and when I asked my dad, like, how come you haven't told me as much as I hear from British black people about slavery? He was just like, because at some stage you have to move on. I wouldn't want you to lead in life with, you know. However, when I went to Barbados, I could go to certain period properties like plantation houses and I would find my surname there. Do you know what I mean? So I think the same goes for like the police and the black community, the British black community, because what I can't stand is people saying the black community or certain communities, and they're extremely different. So all my Caribbean family who have come here, but they weren't born here, do not really relate to like third and fourth generation black, yeah, British, black people.
British people. Yeah.
We don't see
English boy, you know that one.
Yeah, like when I come here, it's like, no. And, yeah, no, it's true though.
No, but it's facts. I mean, it's,
and that's why I go back to the whole like generational trauma. When it comes to like the black community and the police, I'm not saying it wasn't justified, but a lot of people in the 70s would tell their children, like, the police are not for you. They're not on your side. F the police. If you see the police, run. Because granted, a lot of black people were battered by the police historically. But if you keep on passing that on, you will create this angst of the police will never be there for you. But then now I've got several like black friends who are firearms officers. And if you speak to a lot of young black boys who are stabbed, the police have to be first there, and they're the ones that often save their lives. But you don't hear that, do you? You don't hear the man them say, "Rah, I'm going to keep it like 100. I'm alive because of a police officer." You don't hear that.
Yeah, because of the ops.
Well, but this has been created, this whole narrative. I'm not saying there isn't racism, but there's issues wherever you go. After I was homeschooled, I went to an all-black school. I was probably one of the fairest in the school. There was loads of like issues in terms of colorism there.
Interesting.
So there's, my point is, you're going to, it's human nature, the us and them theory. You're always going to have issues of...
There's two things I want to ask, but firstly, at what point did you feel racialized? Because you moved from Barbados, you gone to Tottenham. Mm. At what point did you feel like you were aware of your race as it having an effect on how people were treating you, or you thought that it could be?
I don't know, because the whole concept of being of mixed origin only came into play in 2001. So most of us who were like millennials, we were all, whether you were mixed race or not, called black. And then there was this whole online conversation. It's just like, you're not black. And it's like, well, I'm seen as black, but you can't speak on black issues. And I'm like, okay, would you say that to Bob Marley? Would you say that to Akala? Would you say that to all the people? Or when you say, oh yeah, this is one of us, Lewis Hamilton.
Two of the most articulate people ever to speak on race, by the way.
But they're mixed race.
But I think that's part of the reason why, like, speaking as a mixed race person, the liminal identity allows you to see both sides in a way that sometimes if you look at, you're just part from one part of the community, you have a very different experience, right? You have to experience it from the idea of being different and being distinct. And that expresses the nuance.
I think being mixed, you feel offended for both sides or like, well, three of my sides. So that's the only difference. I think when you're like, hardly anyone's fully black, especially if you're from the Caribbean. But if you consider yourself to be fully black, you're just dealing with people that don't really like black people. But then if I'm in a room and someone says something like a joke about white people, it's like, oh, well, you people don't wash. You don't wash your chicken. You don't wash your skin. It's like, well, my family do. So you're constantly having to try and like...
But white people do get pod for that though.
I was going to say, what do you say to the like the Asian side though? Because I'm like you. I'm half Indian. But
are
I'm
you?
Jamaican Indian.
Okay.
So my people came from Jamaica time ago. But they look at my dad. They see this Indian man who speaks patois, who's called Elvis, and who's just a Yardie. He's just a Jamaican man. And they're so confused. And I feel like you're forced to pick a side. So for me, it's Jamaica, India, Ghana, the UK, all of these heritages. And I notice the Asian side doesn't see me as Asian, whereas the black side is more likely to see me as black. And you're a similar mix.
I think that's probably because you're Jamaican Indian, right?
Yeah, but we still got I'm still going home eating dal and rice. Like yeah, all these. Yeah, lot, yeah, do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
My grandparents are worshipping the same gods. They're just, 3,000 miles away, wherever it is, from Jamaica to India. So I never felt culturally indistinct from these people, but yet I was made to feel different because ours is just a different representation of a culture from only 100 years
and
ago.
And how the community treated
you
as well.
Exactly. Yeah, and they didn't know. They didn't know about.
I think it's funny because if I go to a new workplace and they find out that like my mother was born in Pakistan, they kind of embrace me on the surface. But if I was like, I remember I dated a Pakistani guy, and he was just like, oh, I don't know how I'm going to introduce you to like my family. They're never going to accept you. So it's like taking
don't
it away.
Because they have a lot of racism towards black people as well.
Do you know what? I don't know if it's necessarily... I'm very like careful to say racism. It, obviously, it could be seen as it. But I think their bigger issue is more religion and culture. Because the same attitude that Pakistani people have, they have to people... Bangladesh.
Who aren't the same type of Muslim.
Yeah, like you cannot bring, well, now, the new age generation. But historically, you can't bring a Bangladeshi person home if you're Pakistani. Mm. Or you can't bring, if you're Muslim Pakistani, you can't bring a Sikh person home or a Hindu person. Mm. So I think it's these cultural, like, nuances. And then when people place this on ethnic minorities, I have to remind them, let's look at the history of the UK, like the Jacobites, the Scottish, they hated each other.
Yeah.
They actually beat their own language out of them, like Gaelic. So I hate it when there's this idea of, oh, it's just black people, Asian people. Everyone hates everyone. Like, let's be frank.
You think racism is natural, don't you?
I wouldn't say it's natural, but it's more like I mentioned earlier, the more like it's us and them. Like, that's innate. That's natural.
Yeah,
in-group,
out-group bias.
Yeah, exactly. You're naturally going to... It's the same thing of, like, when you support a team or a football team. You're naturally going to go towards who you feel you can relate to a bit more.
Tribism.
Do you know what I mean?
Tribism.
Do you not think we should work to try and overcome that, though?
You won't be able to.
You don't think so? Not at all?
We've definitely overcome a lot, though, in terms of just that inbuilt basis of thinking.
I think we were, and I think now we've gone back.
We've regressed.
Yeah, because now with exposure, more young people are getting involved in politics. So it's not like, oh, what, are you a Tory? Or when I was maybe 17, no one gave a fuck. Like,
and what are you, though?
I don't agree that anyone should be loyal to any party, because they're so movable now. You know, and like I said, I've worked for the Labour Party. I've voted and campaigned with the Brexit Party. I would vote for reform right now, and I voted for Conservative. And if Labour or the Greens did something, if their manifesto reflected what I wanted in life, I would vote for the Greens.
What would be your three things to reflect what you want in
your
life?
What I want in life?
Yeah.
Taxes.
Higher or lower?
Lower. Okay. I want lower taxes.
You want no taxes?
I actually think...
Why don't you just move to Dubai then?
Because I find Dubai really soulless. Like, I like going into the English countryside and seeing, like, the period buildings. I like going to the Caribbean and seeing the culture. Like, when I
went
to...
You like heritage.
I love heritage. I love history. When I went to Dubai, I felt like someone pressed a button and a city popped up, and that's all there is to it. Even like going on the beach, it's like, are you joking? There's massive, huge buildings behind. Like, my granddad went to Dubai when it was just a desert. Like, I know everything has to start from somewhere, but I felt nothing in Dubai, so I could never live there.
Okay, so taxes is one.
Taxes is one. I am what you'd say is culturally conservative in terms of, I don't like a big push of, you know, I like how Conservative and Reform are very careful with how children are taught about identity politics, or like, I have no issues with LGBTQ, but I just don't think any form of sexuality should be taught to children. That's one of the reasons why I left the Labour Party, because when I was a part of it, it was when Momentum was coming in, and we had to have an argument with a guy who wanted to identify as a woman on Wednesdays only, and he got the woman's officer role. And like, there was uproar, rightly so. So for me, that left a bad taste in my mouth. Anything that's a bit more left tends to have those sorts of politics, and I don't like those sorts of politics.
I think that's quite a fringe part of the left. That
yeah, I'm trying to think which Labour Party you were in and what kind of people were there. I think the kind of fringe cultural stuff is fringe and cultural. Yeah. I don't think it represents the main kind of stream of the left in this country at all.
If you tell me then, if you were to say what are the main 3 to 4 left-wing policies, let me see if I can relate or like any of them.
Okay, that's good.
Economic redistribution to some of the poorest in society.
Okay.
No, that's not for you.
What? No.
What does that look like? taxing
the rich. It looks like, taxing people with the broader shoulders. And I think that is becoming increasingly hard to locate because, as you know, you could be a graduate in London on 100K, but tuition fees, which is a lively topic at the moment, you could be renting your flat, hard to save, all of those things. So I think there needs to be a reconsideration as to who is actually the wealthy in society.
So that's why
but I think we definitely have an obligation to the poorest to make sure that they're in receipt of a dignified life like the rest of us.
Okay.
I think that we should obviously fund our public services. I think that is the hallmark of a civilization that is respectable, that is humanitarian in its outlook, and also has a vision for humanity going forward that represents decent health, decent education, all of that kind of stuff. The third thing I would say is ensuring that actually the state has the ability to run some of its most effective utilities. So when we're looking at trains, when we're looking
nationalizing
water. But also not just nationalizing, but people have a say in how they're determined. So the state doesn't just have an overarching capacity to run these organizations, but people who consume them, people who work in them, actually have some democratic ownership of where they go. And then the final one is, I think on big issues of the day, geopolitics, climate change, there's actually a cohesive response that ensures that Britain is put first. And I don't think that is an unreasonable
thing. You must love that though, Britain first.
Well, there has to be a Britain first.
Yeah,
for approach. What climate change?
No, for everything.
Strategic autonomy to make sure that Britain protects interests first and foremost.
Yeah, what does that look like geopolitically?
Well, at the moment, it means that we have to follow America doing whatever the fuck they want to do.
And that's not what it should be.
And you don't like that either, because I know I've seen what you've been tweeting about Gaza.
No, 100%. That's probably my most left-wing, what people would say. But my thing is, I kind of understand, do not like Keir Starmer as a leader, but I understood his response in recent situations. Just because, we've left the EU, whether you agree or not, we're here now. If you look at our capabilities in terms of military, we've got nothing.
Yeah.
We don't manufacture. We don't create. Our growth just went up by, 0.1% just because of Land Rover. Like, that's pathetic, one company. So my point is, if we piss off the biggest in the world, which is unfortunately the hugest consumer, America, the Chinas, the whatever, who's gonna back us?
Well, that's the problem right now.
But
do
you not think that the motivation of government should be to ensure that we actually have that capacity domestically?
How would we have that capacity?
Well, I think you're right. That is the challenge.
We have to reindustrialize.
Do you not think we have to? I mean, something that I'm quite interested in is reforming the welfare states. That means people have the opportunity to work and be productive. Something of that sort, and then they can redistribute the wealth again to the poorest people, attracting business through some form of competitive levy. I think things like the national insurance obviously was a disastrous policy industrialization or
and building
working.
Our own sovereign tech
as
well.
I just don't think there's that hunger, and I know this sounds really archaic and not the most positive, but what gets people working is needs must. And when you do have again, I've worked with alongside the DWP, the welfare state. Before I was in housing, I worked in welfare to work. And I just think where there is that safety net that is too big, in my opinion, it allows people to feel like they don't have to work, if that makes sense.
Don't you think we've got to a point now where the way our political economies are, there is essentially a class of indentured servitude? So people who want to work for Deliveroo, for instance, you ain't got many natives who are putting themselves forward to be delivery drivers.
Don't you think that they should be forced to?
But this is what's it. I think if it paid a wage that was meaningful, then people would do that.
What does that look like? Because as far as I'm concerned, the best time, going back to when I was younger, the best time to take a low wage, to just have some pocket money.
As a teenager.
I'm at home. Yeah, okay, if you're telling me that you're 18 and you've got two kids to look after and a wife, fair enough, I hear you. But more time, that age group, you're at home. You're not really paying bills.
Yeah, you could do something.
Then that is the perfect time to have a low wage, while you don't have those huge responsibilities, and work your way up. But I'm speaking to young people that are like, I'm not doing that. So my first job was selling bin liners at 17. It was not attractive. The money was not huge, but there was something about the mid-millennials, I'll call them, that we thought we wanted some money. But if you look at the welfare recently, we've had the hugest increase from young people around 24 applying for benefits. But then a year and a half ago, we had vacancies that were like north of a million. So something's going wrong where you have a million vacancies and then you have young people that are like, man's not doing that.
And then claiming mental health on top of it.
But you can go onto TikTok and really see how you can be ADHD. Like, no, I'm not going to say that there isn't warranted for some people, but I think this is the era where people, unless it's snazzy, flashy, so they can go into a career that's straight like, that's what I want to do. Like, forget this whole want. Like, historically, the reason why people got a job is because they needed to eat. So I think, yes, have a welfare state. I think it's good that there's a safety net. One day I might fall on my ass and I might need it. But it should be, I think it should have a limit. Like, you shouldn't be able to just go and apply for benefits and then 3 years, you're still on it.
You think people should be forced into some form of work after that?
I'm not going to say dragging, but you shouldn't be able to claim benefits if you're living with your parents who are working and you just can't decide that you want to work.
Do you think that is the attitude of the country? Because I was at home over Christmas and, like, left-wing Labour people who are working class people have that exact view. Do you think that is just the spirit of the country, or do you think you embrace like a right-wing philosophy to work? Because to me, I don't know, I feel like you represent mainstream opinion.
Yeah, what you just said, I'm like, we've said the same stuff.
I don't like to like use these banners, because if you go, especially outside of London, and you go to these sorts of hardworking, working class communities, they would see themselves as like, historically, Labour left wing to a degree. Like, Labour was supposed to be for the working man. Even if you look at the
name,
working class.
Or Labour.
Yeah, Labour. Yeah,
work.
There you go. So I think for me, it sounds right wing now because that's what people would say. But let's get back to, okay, you should just have to. And I think people feel motivated when they have to do something. You know, if you know that you want to be able to go to that first holiday with your boys or your girls or whatever, like get into a job and you'll realize how fulfilling it is. Even if it's a job you don't like, you'll meet other people. You'll be able to put something on your CV. That's empowering. Leaving school or A-levels and sitting at home for 4 years and thinking, oh, I haven't found the perfect thing that I enjoy. You're going to fall into depression.
So you think we're just a work-shy generation?
100%.
Do you think we're decadent?
In what way? I know the term, but what?
People think there's an argument now, and if you listen to like people like JD Vance and them lot, they would say that the problem with the West is that it spends more than it makes. You know, we're hooked on debt. We can't make the numbers add up. We always want more.
The ultra consumer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we are the ultra consumer. And I think, to be honest, like consumer capitalism, I don't see anything wrong with those things if you can back your share. So,
yeah, but we clearly can't right now. Like, finance.
No, I mean, from an individual like, point of view, if you have worked hard and you want to go Louis Vuitton and get 3 phones and dispose of them, that you've worked to do that.
You can get phones at Louis Vuitton.
But do you think?
No, I'm saying.
But do you think that is like the reality for most people of our generation? Because I just don't recognize that.
No, there's a lot of smoke screens. There's a lot of like, it's so funny because, again, working on the front line, I would regularly go to homes and I wouldn't recognize people from online, and they're living the best dream online. And I'm like, this
ain't doing nothing at home.
Bro, like, if people saw your yard, like, this isn't a reality. So I think there's such a pretense, especially around like my generation, a bit younger, of I'm lit, you're not lit.
Yeah.
Like you're struggling.
Do you know what it reminds me of? That meme where it's like Bill Gates' outfit versus guy from Hood. And it's like the only thing that's expensive is his glasses or whatever.
But Bill Gates will wear a plain t-shirt and it's £600.
Yeah, low key, innit? But the thing is it's less ostentatious.
Yeah, but do you know what that is? That annoys me a little bit as well, because okay, yes, when you're working class or come from a poor background, you want to prove yourself, right?
You want to present as if, or project that power.
But at the same time, when you look at certain ethnic minorities, historically, we were ostentatious, we were decadent. You just have to go to a Nigerian wedding. You just have to go to like an Asian wedding.
It's human desire.
Yeah, and that's what I'm not that mad at where it comes to America versus Britain. Like, you do well in Britain and you want to show it, it's frowned upon. But in America, it's like celebrated. And I think we need to see more of that, because it would give people, especially the younger generation, like, yeah, why can't I show off a bit? I've worked hard for this.
Do you think it's a community problem? Because I see a lot of people like us who are just gloating on social media.
What, showing off?
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of them are young black people. As much as there are as many white people, but at least on my feed, it seems disproportionate.
I think that's a culture thing. Not necessarily black, because a lot of black people actually find that repulsive. It's a class thing. And that's another reason why, because we're a small percentage, I'll say we, but because the black communities are small percentage in the UK, everyone gets bundled together. But you have these sort of subcultures that are very different. And I think the loudest culture is that culture, the urban, like hip hop, grime, drill, influencer, Love Island, like they're all merging as
one. Entertainment industry.
Exactly. And it is driven and propelled by a lot of like black people. So it's a good thing and a bad thing, but I am seeing more positive conversations happen now. Like, bro, you're showing your rollie, have you got a house? Or like, those are the, it's progressed a bit.
Do you claim credit?
slightly.
Because I feel like you get a lot of hate, you know, for a lot of times. Sometimes you'll say something and it will be like, I know you're trying to get a reaction out of people, but it tends to be, bootstrap yourself. That's your message, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, essentially.
You know, if you're in the trenches, no one's going to change it for you except you. So do something. That's your message, right? Mm-hmm. And people like to say, I saw Bouncer say this once about you, that you look down on the black podcast community, for instance, that you look down on them.
Elements of it, I do. I'm not ashamed to say it. Mm. Like, Bouncer was like disrespecting Shadeborough. He is a one-man Shadeborough now. Do you know what I mean? I have no issues of people talking whatever they want to talk. But when you have too many people and the output is bullshit, then it's not great, is it? Like, you have other communities or sects of people that they're talking about property, they're talking about fintech, they're talking about, and then you go on to our area and it's like, who fucked who, or who did this, or this guy did this. It's like, is there any substance to what's going on? He has posted a few positive things, but I just think...
You're going to give him his flowers?
I don't know about flowers. But you know what it is? I feel like that whole area is from roadman to rapper, attempt at streamer and podcaster. So it's people who did the roadman life. They either went to prison, got arrested, sold drugs, whatever. Then they tried their hand at music. And if you weren't good at music, you tried to be a music manager. So then that was the, like, and then that's kind of evolved, and they've realized that streaming can make more money than rappers now. And then they're just grabbing mics and talking whatever they can to, because these types of guys, and it's quite sad, these types of guys can't lend themselves to any form of like real career. They can give entrepreneurship a go. They can try and set up businesses.
It is very entrepreneurial. They reinvented themselves. They've failed upwards. They've gone again.
To a degree. Okay, to a degree, if you want to call it. But entrepreneur is someone that lends themselves to multiple areas and streams of income. And it has to be consistent and regular.
Well, they take risks.
The way that people just throw around entrepreneur. Are you really an entrepreneur?
You can't call. If you call yourself an entrepreneur, you're immediately not an entrepreneur.
That's my rule.
It's in your Instagram bio. Shut up, man. You're an entrepreneur. You're 20.
To me, you're not an entrepreneur. If let's say, if Bouncer or any of these other guys can consistently put out content, generate a decent level of income, and then from that, they elevate and have various different hands in different pies that are all relatively successful, and then they can be a specialist in those areas, to me, that's entrepreneur. You can't just like have a mic and be like...
But how are you not... How is Bouncer, just for listeners who listen for politics, Bouncer, how would you describe Bouncer? He's an entertainment first kind of Instagram personality. The guy is clearly talented at holding people's attention. He's funny. He's definitely
got a lot
funny.
To say.
He said the one thing you have on him.
One thing that you've got over me is you know how to read. You get me, yeah? And you're half smart. So there's someone that has, you know, knows how to read that's on national TV.
Objectively funny.
I think if you consistently like Bouncer and you consume Bouncer's content, you're slightly low IQ. That's what? My
is
view.
It? Is yeah.
Really?
I like Bouncer and we read philosophy.
Yeah, but you don't consistently only consume Bouncer-like content.
I watch a lot of filthy fellas.
You will watch it, have a giggle, and then you'll also read a book, and then you'll also expose yourself to other things.
Yeah, I ain't watching the live streams.
There are people out there that sit on their live streams or watch every single thing, and when you look at all of their internet history, it's all mini Bouncers.
Yeah, but you can't hate on those people.
I don't hate on them. Me, if I say that it's slightly low IQ to expose yourself to that sort of content as a grown-ass person.
You're saying diversify the portfolio.
To me, it is low IQ. I'm going to have to rebuke that one.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. Personally, I think it's just like cultural snobbery. I like what my man's got to say. I think Bouncer's got a lot to offer. And okay. I think...
What would you say he has to offer?
I think he's got an insight, a perspective. As you say, he can hold my attention, make me laugh. But I'm also a person that will pick up a book and do all the other stuff.
But this is the thing, you know, for the whole attention thing, right? Yeah. The whole attention thing is,
rage.
I genuinely believe anyone can do that. Also, okay, if I get a mic and start saying, like, I walked into a room and two of you were having a threesome, people are going to start looking at what I've got to say. No, I've made it up. A lot of these guys are making up stories. Don't tell them about that story. But do you understand where I'm coming from? That is not talent.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
You
if
are,
you're lying
that
for
you
clout,
are being,
lying
that,
for clout.
They're hyping.
Yeah.
Hyping, lying, overly exaggerating.
Yeah, embellishing.
It's more than embellishment.
Right.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, okay, let's take what he said about ZZ Mills. Oh, yeah, she's sniffing. She needs to. He did about 5 videos about ZZ Mills sniffing.
Actually, I didn't see that, to be fair.
We have not seen any video
no
of ZZ
Mills.
So you're essentially praising a guy that has used a story. Okay.
To elevate his own position in some way. Yeah. I mean,
that's not respectable. It's not respectable. Like, if he, okay, the only way it would be respectable, taking ZZ away from it, let's just say any person who's taking drugs. If he was to say, do you know what, there's been an incident and, you know, this man or woman's really dropped off, we want them to get help, you know, we've been working with certain organisations, da, da, da. But that's not sexy, is it?
No.
It's not fun, is it? So you're not contributing in a positive way to society, even if, like me, people might hate me and say, oh, you're just being negative. But if you actually look at my content of let's do better, let's work harder, let's educate ourselves.
You literally
why
stand.
Why are we not in these rooms?
You literally
of politics?
Stand on business. Your whole platform is on business, which I respect.
But do you
respect.
Not think they're doing their business though? Like, as but, much as your business is for the community or for yourself, these lot are evidently doing something for themselves and have a platform. So you can't hate on that.
So where do you stop then? Because, okay, you can lie, you can, as you said, embellish, you can make up stories about people, you can actually ruin people's reputation just so you can
none
get those
clicks.
Okay.
None of that shit's okay.
That's not sustainable. That's not entrepreneurial
yeah.
shit.
Yeah.
No,
it's not
that's
sustainable.
Just hate. Yeah.
That's just hate.
Just so that people can be like, oh, did you see
it's
what
fraud.
Miles
do you know what it is? It's fraud.
But do you not think it's up to the audience to develop a bit of a critical eye about some of the things that these people are saying? Because I think as much as the onus is obviously
on the creator,
yeah. It's up for the audience to determine what they see to be true and to develop their own considerations as to what that has been said, surely.
Okay, but...
That's not me
it's
defending
like we're,
him.
We're,
but
it's
that's
like we're
just...
changing politics here because you're talking about accountability, but then that's a lot of my politics. And I do agree with that. But where you don't have a stringent... policy of social media, you know that content is going to go to the minds of very young people. We can say till we're blue in the face, it's parents' fault. It's very difficult. So what you've got now are people that suffer with mental health, young people who, you know, they've got a myriad of issues. And there has to be, as a content creator, just as a decent human being, there has to be a slight level of morality of what could this do? If I put this out, what could this do? Do you know? If it was like back in the day where you went to Woolworths or whatever and it said 18 on the CD, that's different because you know that hopefully people over 18 have a level of whatever. It's not just for anyone.
Yeah, we've lost any sense.
We don't have any
of,
control.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you are going to be that person and then you claim to, oh, I'm taking down the old like way of doing things. This is the new way of doing it. We need to do more for the community. And then now you're just espousing lies and horrible clickbait stories. what are you really doing?
But don't. But you do you not think the Shade Borough does that as well, though?
Yeah, like, look, at the end of the day, I see the Shade Borough as like a black Daily Mail.
Yeah, yeah, right? It's black tabloids.
Yeah. It's black tabloids, and I'm not mad at that. What I'm frustrated at is the output. So I can read the Daily Mail today or the latest crappy, like, gossip in that space, but I can also read the Financial Times. I can also, but it's all from that area. Yeah, yeah, yeah. When it comes to ethnic, more predominantly black communities, there isn't that the same strong balance. And,
yeah.
So now, knowing that all of our community is hooked on these things, their day-to-day, and this is why I got into politics, because it's like, me living in Tottenham, I'm going to these political meetings, no one else is there, but we're there online like, yeah, oh, they hate us, the police hate us. When I went to a crime and policing meeting, none of you lot pulled up. So who's to blame? No, because you're consuming garbage online. You don't go to the rooms that matter, that actually influence our lives.
So do you think the answer is for people of the community to basically diversify how we represent ourselves, how we articulate any messages, whether it's culture, politics, whatever it is, or do we just have to be more critical of the Shade Borough?
I think, going back to your point of should the audience be more critical, it's like if you keep on eating McDonald's, you're going to find broccoli disgusting. And there is, we should, as a collective or audience, try and show love and appreciation and platform those who do talk sense or who do talk things that actually are poignant and would help us in life. Does that make sense? But then I feel that if some of these characters were more knowledgeable, let's say, for example, if Bouncer went away and read, like...
He can't.
Audiobook.
By his own admission.
If he listened to audiobooks, let's say for
you best
solid
tune in, big man.
Year, yeah?
Yeah.
He could probably have better content to mix with the content he's doing to get people. He does. I do see him trying. Like, he'll do little political things, or he platforms this light-skinned guy, Tris, in Dubai, who does, like, finance stuff or whatever. So I do see he... Okay.
It's always finance.
I just hate all this fucking Rio Ferdinand's in Dubai. It's all about, like, how do you game the system? None of it's ever about, like, how do we exist in...
Well, critically shape the world to a better future, surely.
Or you live
surely.
In a society, bro. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think a lot within the community, especially if you come from a deprived background as well, you feel like the state hasn't intervened any way to support your life in any...
But it won't. Like, whether it's extreme left or extreme right or anywhere in the middle, the state historically hasn't been, I don't think, for anyone. Like, they have these notional, like, ideas of, oh, yeah, we're going to change things. It never happened. I can't... Since you've known about politics, what party or even politician can you say that would make sense fiscally first, but also is for the people and has made a change to improve all of our lives? Like, who would you say?
Well, I think the main problem is that you've landed on is that we've had stagflation for 18 years. So the majority of our lives, there has not been some dividend to redistribute. But the New Labour years did do that. They created opportunity. Sure Start was a way to go into communities for people who didn't have access to those means to be able to pull themselves up. They created opportunity.
But politics is always about offsetting those balances that you've just set. It's a case of who can we get to support us whilst you say the fiscal credibility. What's fiscally credible for me as someone of the left is definitely not 14 years of the Tories. But then for someone who's probably been a bit wealthier over the last 18 months, they would look at this government and say, well, actually, this government may not be on my side. So I don't think you'll ever find a politician who can really square that circle, because there are naturally competing interests within a society. It's how you build a political program to kind of integrate all of those challenges, would be my view.
Let me ask you a question, right? You've been someone who has experienced social mobility, right? If you had to explain what the keys were to being an aspirant person and being successful in just three clear values, what would they be?
I would say education. I don't know if they're values, but education, throwing yourself in no matter what, because fear is a huge thing. And I would put as a subheading, like, networking. And I'd also say delayed gratification. Like, that for personally, that's been for me. So when I say throwing yourself in rooms, like, many people that I speak to, why don't you give it? That room's not for me. They don't rate me, or do you know that sort of thing. You've got to get rid of that.
Like, you have to believe in yourself, basically.
Yeah,
or, that you deserve to be in that space and that you should
occupy
a space.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, start rubbing shoulders with people who you rate and respect. And you know, if you're gonna stay in the same area and everyone's scratching around at the bottom, I know that sounds horrible, but you're not gonna elevate yourself. Mm. You know.
Yeah, and so you're a landlord now. And you've obviously spent a lot of time working in housing as well. I feel like a lot of what you've been telling people to do is like, how do you get skin in the game in the capitalist system that we live in, right? Like, how do you get to a place
where our communities where we haven't had skin in the game?
Yeah.
Now probably is the greatest chance that most black and brown people in the country could actually have some skin in the game. And
do you know what it is for me? It's like, so most of my friends now own their own property. And that's because I'm not going to take, you know, credit for all of it. But I've literally sat them down. I'm like, why don't you own a house? This is just like one area. I'm not just saying home ownership is the answer. And they're like, oh, I can't. It goes back to that self-belief. And I'll go through their accounts. I'm like, you could have bought a house 2 years ago. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's something as simple as that, which I think is one of the easiest things to do, the easiest assets to generate income. I know you guys don't really agree with that. But like, there's certain things.
No, I don't disagree with that in... It's true. Mm. I'm saying that should it be that way? Because one of the problems we've now got is asset overinflation. Mm. So the problem that I've got with the system as it is, and this is why I've got a problem with people like Thatcher, for instance, was that when she sold off all the council houses, we stopped building houses. We stopped building social housing. And clearly what's that happened then is that if you've had capital and you've accumulated it, you've been able to accrue more and more and more. You've been able to invest more and more.
But do you know how I look at it and justify it? And I know it sounds weird. We're never going to get reparations in terms of like if you're from or associated with the black community, right? Sure. And I accept that. So what I can't stand about the left or like elements of Labour is you know that black and brown people have been disadvantaged for God knows how long. And now you want us to not benefit from capitalism when your family or your parents... No.
Yeah.
You sacrifice. You do socialism over there. It's our opportunity. We as black and brown people should be capitalists on steroids until we see an even keel. And we're not going to see it. Like, as far as I'm concerned, if we keep on wanting the same government that's held us down for over 500 years, then we're going to stay at the bottom. And I know this sounds a bit like a conspiracy theory, but the whole welfare system, if you look at the first generation of like the Windrush, they came here in a way kind of capitalists and conservatives. Yeah. They bought up Brixton, Tottenham, Hackney, Notting Hill, and some of those houses now are worth what? Yeah. And they kept on doing that. And then as soon as the welfare... Like all of their children, and I think because of racism, they were really soft on their children. They didn't say, come on, you've got to be like us, you've got to be like us. And then a lot of them went back home and left their children. And their children got into the welfare cycle. And that cycle of, okay, social housing. Oh, I could kind of buy, but I don't want to lose my social property, like tenancy agreement. But you're not making money in there.
So do you think there was a moment in recent history where black communities basically got poorer? Because that to me sounds like what you're saying is that we had wealth when we came here, or at least we tried to get wealth, and then something went wrong. Maybe
no, but that's the thing. When Caribbean people came here, they were not wealthy at all, but they did things like pardner. Do you know pardner?
Yeah. My parents do pardner.
There we go. They did. You know,
explain what pardner is.
It's essential.
So basically, when we first came here, we couldn't open up bank accounts, so everyone drops a hand in. A hand's about £20. Everyone, there could be like 10, 15 people, and they take it in money to give you the lump sum. So the lump sum could be like £1,000. Then everyone takes it in turns and pays their partner until it's gone round. And that's what allowed a lot of black people to buy their houses back in the days.
Yeah, so this whole idea of, it's impossible now, you dealt with like NF, you dealt with skinheads chasing you down the road, you dealt with not being able to get a job and being like not even be able to have a rental where Asian and black families had to share homes. Mm. And we still managed to do it then. We still managed to own, like, so many of my friends now, their grandparents own these huge big fuck off houses. And we managed to do it then. So when I hear excuses now where things are nowhere near as bad as they were back then, and we're still like, how do we do it? Yeah. How do we do
it? You're talking about a more solidaristic time. You're talking about a time when people...
What do you mean solid?
So with solidarity. Yeah, there was more solidaristism. There was more solidarity then. People were able to collectively bargain together because there was trust within those communities and an understanding that you needed to do something.
One thing I'm curious, I feel like our generation's losing the pardoner spirit. I did my partner when I had a paper round. I got £750. That took me on holiday. Yeah, yeah. I did my partner when I was a paper round. But I feel like I don't see any young people from the community talking about the financial methods that our parents and our grandparents had to do in order to get a nicer life for us. One thing I get really pissed off about is I always say my grandparents didn't come here to play around. They didn't come here just for us to chill out and have a nice time. These lot came to make sure that we were winning in whatever we were doing. And you can start to see some of that now. But I feel like not just in our community, but I think you're right, it's a class thing. There's a defeatist spirit that, oh, I can't do this, or I'm going to have to do this.
No, there's no community, that's why. It's like what you said, with like the solidarity, as much as I'm agnostic, what underpinned that was the church.
Was religion, 100%.
It was. 100%. And when you look
but do you not
at
think a shared
groups,
sense of racism, though?
Say that again?
Do you not think a shared sense of racism also underpinned it? Because the church is one thing, but like but the Indian, Muslim communities, the, yeah, Hindu communities, yeah, Sikh communities, we all had a common experience in that we were racialized as black. And as you say, the state was against us, whether that was in the police, whether that was in housing, whether that was in education. And so it can't just be the church, surely, as a way
I think it was a common interest of culture as well. You're coming over from a small, really sunny island, and you realize that, you know, Doris, a couple rows down, is cooking ackee and saltfish. You want to go and see Doris because you want to feel at home. I would hope to believe, because when I speak to many of the older generation, they tried to not concentrate on the racial element. I feel like the racial element became like an obsession with the Pan-African movement. That's a conversation another day. But the whole from like the 70s, that's when you saw what your parents experienced, and then now you've got hate in your heart. I think with our like the older generation, they just saw it as, okay, we are different. People are going to not like us, but we're here to do
the job. But they felt British as well. That's the thing is, I think about my grandparents. These lot felt like they were British people. They were just black at the time that were experiencing disproportionate levels of inequality and prejudice. But they never, as much as they would say, okay, yeah, they're from Jamaica, they're from Ghana, they're from wherever, I don't think they ever lost a sense that they were here to do something and they're buying into a country for the future.
And they'd also grown up in those schools where you would have the portrait of
the queen or whatever.
You know,
they still love it.
Because we're all Commonwealth babies. All of and that's one thing I was curious about.
Yeah.
I mean, you literally come from the East and the West and you're met here. Mm. My family come from a similar background. East your family's from...
My grandma's Chinese Jamaican.
Oh.
And my dad's Australian. But I was saying to Javan before, when we were saying we were going to get you on, I was like, you basically have the same politics and attitude as my grandma.
Yeah.
Like there's an old school Caribbean sort of grit your teeth and bear it and just get on with it. Keep calm and carry on.
Yeah,
you know,
literally.
Really, like,
that's
it's really
what,
that
that's what I British get confused spirit. About, though, because that's why I don't relate. Like, obviously, I grew up in the ends and all that stuff, but I do feel a huge disconnect that when I go back home to Barbados, everyone thinks like me. They're like, what is it with this cry? Or, like, you know, when there's a big situation like the Chris Cabba in Barbados, everyone was just like, well, he deserved it. Yeah. Why was he living a life like that?
Yeah.
Or there is a huge support for the police in our Caribbean islands. Like, yes, go and get him. He's over there. Bring him. Like, there isn't that sort of... And I understand why, you know, we weren't welcomed or supported by the police. So now we see them, like you said, as the ops. But there has to be this separation of... stop the celebration of crime and, you know, all that sort of culture.
But the problem is there's cycles of deprivation and then there's no truth and reconciliation. And so that's where the problem is. We need to shift this in the community, because at the end of the day, if you're in trouble, you should be able to call someone who is going to come and help you. But a lot of people still feel like, I don't trust them.
I don't know if it's that anymore as much. I don't. I think it's more like the adoration for the whole gang ethos, like I don't snitch, I don't do this, I don't do that. Do you know what I mean? It's entrenched in the culture of it also not being cool.
In the top boyification of life.
I think that is a huge issue, because you're not going to be able to ever elevate, because it goes down, it trickles down into other things. I don't want to put no money in the bank. I don't want to I don't want to do work with the white man, because that was another thing. Where I speak to loads of people and I'm like, here's a good job and I'm not being underneath the white man, or the whole like, I'm going to make sure I retire by 35 because I'm not.
But that's ahistorical though, because back in the day you was literally working with everyone from all over the people worked in the industrial site with all of these other all these people. That was basically how multiculturalism was born. Was because, you know, when I think about it in terms of the communities that my grandparents were living in when they moved over, it was like, if you didn't have a lot, then everyone together would have something.
So you would
pull together.
But that's not just an ethnic thing. I think that's...
That's a human thing.
With the way of the world now, even if you go to like white areas, whether that's well-to-do or working class, they don't really know their neighbours anymore. Or you were in the summer...
The death of community. But this is a consequence of your politics, though.
Why is it a consequence
because
of...
Because hyper-individualism,
the atomization of communities. It became, you know, Margaret Thatcher, there is no society. You know, the only thing that matters is this island.
Why can you not be successful,
getting rich
though,
at the expense of others, largely, is how it seems to me, or not having a sense that you have an obligation to someone else.
No, because when you go to middle class areas, they still have community and a lot of them are capitalists. So how does that work?
Because they have the richness to be able to afford to be. Whereas for everyone else, the system that...
Hang on, pause.
Yeah.
So I no longer want to find out who my neighbour is because I can't afford to, or I can afford to. Why does money even come into it? Where historically you would actually go and introduce yourself. You'd say, hi, I've just moved into the neighbourhood, blah, blah. I did it recently when I moved and everyone was like, oh, that's really nice. Okay. And now we're all kind of cool. We've got a WhatsApp group talking about parking and shit. Like, you know, it to me, that's nothing to do with money or finances.
That's a culture.
It's to do with this whole like... Yeah, maybe technology as well.
I think education is part of it as well, right? People who've grown up in that sort of community understand the value in it, and then they transfer, and their behaviour is conditioned by that. But I think what's happened is that because the system has pushed us in a way of thinking, right, the only thing I need to take care of is this little box, you know, or my home, my house, my immediate... People have lost that sense of actually there's a world that exists outside of this, that actually sometimes being in service to that community as well and not wanting anything back from it is gratifying and edifying for your character.
I think it's the other side. I think the welfare state has enabled people to not look after each other because they think the state will. So when I had to do a lot of possessions, I would often go above and beyond. I'd be like, okay, if her mother was going to be made homeless and she's with her children and I've done everything in my power, I would ask her, like, where's the father? I would get the father's number. I'd be like, you know your children are about to be made homeless. Do you have anything to add or say? Oh, yeah, but she's on housing benefit. Like, let them sort it. Like, that would be the repeated response I would get from loads of, like, baby fathers or the fathers of the children.
What's it got to do with me?
Because they know there's that safety net. Whereas historically, you would know. And that's why I kind of am the way I am. Because if I'm allowed to keep more of my money, I'm not taxed to the hilt, I'm more likely going to want to pay into my community. I think it's horrific that we beg the same government that's never done us any favours for youth centres. Please open youth centres. No, we should be able to make enough money to say, do you know what? Let's create our own centres and not have to rely on a government. That's how I think the world should work. Because that's how, before welfare, everyone looked, okay, Johnny didn't have dinner tonight and, you know, maybe his mum's not. We're going to feed him because we've got the money and it goes around in a circle. There wasn't welfare those days. Now that there's welfare on steroids, no one gives a shit because you can go on and sign on.
And that's what we're starting to see in the UK with specific immigrant communities, where they are now getting the wealth. They're able to form their own communities of schools, of businesses. You've got lawyers,
absolutely,
you've got accountants, you've got all of the trades that you need that exist within particular communities, and some are just left behind.
And I'm glad that you said that, because most of my tenants are people on 5-year visas, and they tell me the stories of what they've come from. They have nothing and they're here to work. They're like, they wouldn't even conceptualize welfare. I know that comes from a not having nothing, so it's not, you know, normal to them. But I just think that's also a positive thing, because when you look at like the Kurdish community that's only been here for 20 years, they own most of the shops up and down the high street now.
In Tottenham,
Tottenham, Green Lanes, North London. And then you go to other areas, and it's a similar thing. They came here. I used to look after families that came from Iraq, like before, and they said we saw our families being shot, all this stuff. But now we own like how many businesses?
But then Reform says we want to abolish indefinite leave to remain, and you know these tenants, and a lot of them are hardworking people. How do you square that?
I think it's difficult because I think that a lot of working class people have felt that they've been forgotten about.
How do you identify working class? I'm really curious about this.
When I say working class white people, I mean the ones that... I like to separate the ones that just rely on benefits. I don't think it's fair to call them working class. But I mean the ones that... They haven't got an education, so to speak. They may be left school at 16.
Sorry, ignore that. Ignore the timer.
I would just say anyone that is on a low salary but does have a willingness to work. And they know, we know, there are a lot of people. We have to accept that not everyone is going to climb that ladder. And I don't think we should make everyone feel that they have to. If you're really happy working, you know, in a factory or whatever, and you want to continue doing that, they should still have some level of a decent life. But those people can't even apply for the jobs because now whenever I go and see those sorts of jobs, they are taken by people that have come into this country.
So in those deindustrialized communities then, where there is a lack of opportunity, what are you saying? Because earlier you were saying that people are work shy. A lot of those people have been families of 2-3 generations now that have been on benefits.
The young people are work shy. I'm talking about the some of the older...
But some of those people in old mining communities, a lot of them lost their jobs. They went onto welfare. They got supported by the state.
And there was nothing to replace those work.
But then you have to move around.
You think they've got... So they've got to leave the communities that they've been from for...
But humans have always done this, like, since the beginning of time. That's why we do have so many different types of people across the world. Like, Syrians weren't able to make money, so an influx came to Barbados. The same with Indians coming to Jamaica. Like, you have to do that. And that's like me saying, I think I should be able to live, like, you know, and buy a house in Tottenham. I can't afford it. I had to move to Essex. Like, and I'm not on benefits. So if I can say that I can do it, why shouldn't other people have that mentality of moving and creating a new... I'll give you an example. The Jewish community, who are normally seen as wealthy in Stamford Hill, have now been outpriced, the younger generation. They have all come together and they've all moved to Canvey Island. Now there's a huge Jewish community in Canvey Island. They're not moaning about it. They've just done what they need to do and go to Canvey Island.
But it sounds like you have more sympathy for the native Brits, though, than necessary to migratory, like people from migratory backgrounds when it comes to this.
No, I think I am quite balanced because at the same time, I always say you can't have like a policy geopolitically of bombing other countries and not expecting them to go somewhere. Mm. So there is that element more. But then I also understand that your working class Brit or English person has essentially nothing to do with that policy. Many of them were marching against the Iraq war. It didn't do anything. So it's not that I feel for them more. I empathize with where they're coming from, you know? And that's the only thing. And when we look at also cultural dynamics of living, lots of Indian people, they can undercut and take those jobs because they will live 6 or 7 in a 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom house. I've seen it.
But when Javan was mentioning earlier about communities where the whole community is taken care of from all the different industries that you need to take care of, do you not think that that's a problem for multicultural Britain? If you have different places where just one ethnicity only meshes with themselves.
And they've got all the resources to do so.
So if you go into like, there's parts of Birmingham, for instance, that we know of, are very much enclosed communities that people feel like they're living.
Well, it's not just Birmingham. I think all over the country, there are communities that exist in silo. Didsbury. Parts of London.
Oh, you mean like just Jewish or just Indian Sikh?
Well, just
or
anybody.
Just like...
And I think where they've been able to create the infrastructure solely for their own sustenance without having to integrate fully within the community or within the society. And all of that kind of power and wealth and cultural capital is concentrated within their own communities. Do you not think that is a problem? Because I think it's a problem when you're superseding the interests of everyone else against your own.
But you can't celebrate that we... as Britain are tolerant, I don't even like that word, but tolerant, and say, you know, we allow under our Human Rights Act, you know, right to worship, religion, all the rest of it, and then say, you know,
you lot have to live here.
Yeah, because, okay, essentially, you have to create a culture, but it's very hard. So going back again to Barbados, there is one culture. You have Gujarati Indians, you have Jewish people, you have like white Bajans, black Bajans, whatever. But everyone's eating macaroni pie and baked chicken on Sunday. Do you know what I mean? In their homes, they might have their...
Yeah, it's like Jamaica, same thing. Yeah.
Exactly. But you can't create that here because it's too late. Like, you would have to try and secularize all these people, and you can't go to Orthodox Jewish community or a Muslim area and say, you'd have to say, give up. If you want to, you'd have to give up.
But do you not think Britain has to assert its values then? Because we can't secularize people. People, we have to assert what we believe to
Would
be true.
Would you tell people to remove their religion then?
No, I think the Christianity is the dominant religion of the country, and you celebrate Christmas and you recognize all of the things that make us a Christian society, but you can practice your faith privately.
You would have to say, get rid of your faith schools, get rid of your community centers that are only Muslim or Jewish or Sikh. You'd have to do that and say, if you want to practice those things, do it in your home, because we need to be multicultural.
But the problem is that France has tried to do that, and it's not exactly made the country mesh together anyway. Lin May, I wish we had more time, but you turned up late and we've got to wrap up in the stew. But thank you so much for coming on.
If you
on
want
what's
me
left.
To come again, I will.
You need a party. It's all
right. Come on. All right.
Thank you very much to our producer, Lavinia, in the back for staying late today as well. Big ups. There
thank
we go.
You.